Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your host, Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast. I'm your host, Bob DeMarco. On this edition of the show, I'm speaking with master bladesmith and proprietor of Winkler Knives, Daniel Winkler. Daniel started as a hobbyist, making blades to support other pursuits, but demand for his historically inspired knives and tomahawks grew well beyond his circle, gaining the attention of Hollywood producers and military elite alike. Now, Winkler Knives are some of the most unique, respected, and sought-after hard-use fixed blades on the market. As a matter of fact, you'll find crossed Winkler tomahawks at the center of a popular logo that I'm seeing more and more everywhere. Warms the cockles of my heart. We're going to meet Daniel and talk all about his life in knives. But first, be sure to like, comment, subscribe, hit the notification bell, and download the show to your favorite podcast app so you can listen on the go. And as always, join us on Patreon if you think what we do here is worth it. You can get extra exclusive interviews. You can get all sorts of extra content, knife giveaways, et cetera, et cetera. So just go to theknifejunkie.com/Patreon and check it out. Again, that's theknifejunkie.com/Patreon.
The Get Upside app is your way to get cash back on your gas purchases. Get Upside is an app you put on your smartphone, and whenever you need to get gas, search your area for savings, claim your discount, fill up your tank, and then take a picture of the receipt with your phone. And that's it. You've just got cash back. Visit theknifejunkie.com/save on gas to get the app and start saving. Again, that's theknifejunkie.com/save on gas.
The Knife Junkie is online at theknifejunkie.com.
Daniel, welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. And I want to congratulate you on seeing that logo everywhere. You know what I'm talking about, the crossed tomahawk that are being used in the terminal list.
Yeah, that's been a real popular show, and it certainly has engaged people in looking at Winkler Knives, and then the orders have been tremendous, especially for that particular model, to the point to where right now I think we're probably backlogged on delivery on that particular model by about 10 months. So, it's worth the wait because it's special, but, and it's been great to be associated.
That's good trouble to have to be 10 months, backlogged for tomahawks. That tomahawk in particular, is that the one that was the collaboration with the Sayoc Kali guys?
Yeah. And that back very early in our manufacturing, when we set up Winkler Knives, at that time it was Winkler Knives 2, I worked with Rafael Kianan, the chief tomahawk instructor for Sayoc, in developing that particular model, both with and without the front spike. At the time, he was working with some Naval Special Warfare members that were training in the Sayoc style of using that. And it's got a lot of pretty unique, neat features.
Yeah, that spike is definitely something else. It is actually evocative of some of the older Filipino headhunting axes and that kind of thing. Kind of reminds me of that. But yeah, that it's a very unique design, and you can recognize it right away. I love that thing, and one day I will own one. I want to talk all about that stuff, but first I want to get a little background on you. I was reading your website and discovered that you come out of a reenactment background, a love for historical U.S. knives. How did that happen?
Back when I was in high school in the mid-1970s, I'd always spent a lot of time outdoors with my dad hunting and fishing, and I started gaining an interest in black powder shooting. And so at that time, being a high school student, I didn't have any money to buy equipment with or you know, knives and guns and all that. So I started making things in shop class in school in industrial arts, and back in that time I made knives in high school with shop projects. I made knives and powder horns and shooting bags and it just kind of built from there. And as I realized there were other people that had the same interest, I would start going to these black powder shooting matches. And being I was starting to learn a little bit about knife making, I would make, we'd have things called blanket shoots, where each contestant would lay a prize on a blanket, and then whoever won the match got to pick first. And then if you came in last, you got the can of green beans or, whatever was the least desirable of the prizes. And so, I made a little patch knife on a few of them for the prize on the blanket shoot. And then other people started noticing them that didn't win and get the prize that was picked up early, and said, well, how about you making me one of those? I'll pay you for it. And so that kind of was the start of my knife making career. It actually started very early in the mid to late 1970s, and then on from there.
Did you have someone at that time in those very early days to mentor you, to tell you how to heat treat, to tell you some of these mysteries?
Well, my teacher in the industrial arts class, who was also a good friend and became my hunting buddy, he had some knowledge, and he also had knowledge of how to research and find out things like heat treating. And so it was a lot of trial and error in the beginning. And one side note, this teacher who I had, his name is Michael McGuire, a few months ago, I actually hired his son to work for Winkler Knives. So, and he's doing very good. Jake is a great employee, but that's just a little side note. But so a lot of trial and error in those early projects. And then as I got more into it, I would talk to blacksmiths we live in an area in Western North Carolina with a lot of craft shows and handcrafted items. Because we have a lot of tourist base. And so I talked to blacksmiths, and blacksmiths normally have a little bit of knowledge on making knives because they dabble in a lot of different areas. And so as I went along, I learned more and more about what steels to use and how to properly heat treat or at least get a start in it. And it continued to build and grow. As time went on in 1988, I actually made the move into becoming a full-time knife maker, and I really haven't done anything else since.
Oh, living the dream. So tell me about your love for early American knives and how you would define an early American knife by looks. I mean, I always, of course, think of the Bowie knife, the Western 49, kind of a typical Bowie. But it's, just looking at the knives you made for Last of the Mohicans, for instance, it's very different from what I think of. Define what a U.S. knife from that period of time was, the frontier period, and what about it really drew you to that style?
Well, being I was involved in the black powder industry, well, not really industry, but the lifestyle, and my spare time was spent going to shooting matches and then eventually rendezvous. I liked American history, and so I would study the equipment, go into libraries and museums to see what they might have had in the time period that I was trying to recreate. So early on, and even still yet, in a lot of cases, the knives and tomahawks and axes that I make have an early American design flair. And there were quite a few pieces in the colonies where local blacksmiths would make knives and axes and hatchets. So there's existing specimens of those that I could look at. And then there was a tremendous trade with the Native Americans. So there's a lot of European-made trade knives and tomahawks. And so all of those were helpful in developing a design flair that we just expanded on. And continue building it.
As we were speaking earlier, before we mentioned the Terminalist, you are incredibly popular. Your knives, your work is incredibly popular with special operations operators. And when I learned that, I was always aware of your belt knife before I knew about your broader catalog of work. I always knew about the belt knife and how well respected it was amongst people like myself, collectors and, but then when I learned how popular your work is with special operations individuals, operators and such, it surprised me in such a pleasant way, because these are people who get the highest tech equipment to do their very important job. And then you look at your knives and they have this flavor from the past, and incorporating wood and natural materials as opposed to the latest synthetics, which I would expect on a really advanced commando unit. So how do you account for your immense popularity amongst those individuals?
Well, it still came about because of my work and development of the early American style knives and tomahawks. The first interaction I had with the military special operations was just after the movie Last of the Mohicans came out. And we'll touch on that a little bit more, I'm sure. But I did some work with the principal characters, and there was a member of Naval Special Warfare who had been assigned the task of finding a combination breaching combat hatchet, because they were not satisfied with the things that were on the market, and they weren't really suited for what they wanted to do. And we had built a pretty good reputation. I say we, because by that time my wife Karen was part of Winkler Knives and doing the sheaths and a lot of the business side of it. So we had developed a good reputation both for design, functionality, and the ability to create carry systems that were suitable and worked with a variety of different carry methods. And so from that, the Last Mohicans is this Naval Special Warfare operator noticed the tomahawk that character Magra carried, did a little research, found out that I made it, and contacted me. And so we worked together, and he came to my shop, and we hand-forged a tomahawk and a combination breaching combat axe, which was pretty much an adaptation of a camp axe that I was already making with the black powder trade. And we adapted, put a spike on it, and it's a full tang design, so it's very strong, very durable. And I made this hatchet for him, which he took back to his team, and they all liked it. But at that time, there's no funding for that kind of product, and so we only made one. And he carried it with him during all of his deployments during the first Gulf War. And then it kind of dropped out of sight, and I didn't think much about it until after 9/11, when this operator had retired from the Navy. And it, because of his skill level, had gone back into the military, into Army Special Operations, still had this hatchet that I'd made for him many years before. And his team members liked it and thought they needed one too. And so I actually ended up hand forging, I think it was either 17 or 18 for his particular team within his squadron. And then it kind of grew from there, and they trained and deployed with some of the Naval Special Warfare from his former unit, and they wanted more of them too, and found funding for it, and it got to the point where it was way more numbers than I could do as a hand-forged operation with just me and Karen, and so that was actually the start of, at that time, Winkler Knives too. Two meaning also, because we were still doing the hand forged pieces, we didn't want people confused on what were hand forged that I actually did 100% of the work on, and Karen did 100% of the work on the carriers, to Winkler Knives 2, which we hired a couple of part-time employees to help with that production because it was more repetitious, and we interjected water jet cutting contractors and started building a production business. So that's kind of where the military interaction started, based on my work with Last of the Mohicans and then the reputation that we had built in the custom knife industry doing these early American style pieces.
early on, and I'm not sure if you're privy to this, but early on when you were making these breaching slash combat hatchets for this unit, do you know if there is any difficulty in getting the military to adopt adopt the tomahawk or the hatchet as a useful tool in the on the modern battlefield?
Well, yes and no. You know, the general consensus from the public and the main military at that time was that the hatchet was not really a tool that they would carry. And, you know, it was all about guns and guided missiles and, you know, any other, ordnance that was being deployed. But in actuality, there was a lot more, up close combat than most of the general public could possibly realize. And because of that, a close quarter weapon became very, I won't say popular, but it was very useful with these teams that would have to clear buildings and clear rooms and do up close and personal engagements, because it gave them alternatives to firearms, because in some of the conflicts there would be a lot of innocents that would be close by, and they of course were very conscious of not injuring people that didn't, you know, weren't part of the conflict. And so having a hatchet in combat became very useful in being selective. But then also it became a very useful tool for breaching and some types of operations where they might have to cut a recess into a shelter or something, or a hut or a building to see through or whatever. So there are actually some special training for the use of these hatchets, but it wasn't across the board with all the military. It was pretty well limited to some of the highly skilled operators that actually could get in close and still, you know, they didn't have to 100% rely on the firearm for their combat situation. So even today, there's a lot of attitude about, you know, nobody's going to carry a tomahawk in the belt space on their kit or something like that they probably would never use because they don't need to camp drawers and that sort of thing. And that's true for a lot of people that are in that business. But for the ones that are assigned to certain operations, they do come in very handy, and they're still carried today by a pretty large number of special operations, and even those that are a little further down the food chain, so to speak.
Well, speaking as a non-special operator, I would imagine having one on you would be incredibly reassuring. You know, a nice little security blanket. I've heard many, many stories of our soldiers and Marines who are clearing rooms and someone jumps on their back and it's no longer a gunfight. And I could see how those kind of that kind of weaponry, edged weapons and tomahawks and things that people have been relying on since the beginning of time, would still be reassuring to have, even with all the high tech stuff. When you're designing a tomahawk, it seems like there are two considerations. If it's breaching, you want that full tang. You want it super durable and, for lack of a better term, heavy duty. And heavy is a part of that. But for combat and for, you know, a fighting tomahawk, you want something light that moves around and can recover quickly after a swing. So when you're designing a tomahawk to kind of straddle that line, what kind of considerations go into building it?
Well, tomahawks and knives both are all about geometry, physics, and chemistry. It's you know, it's not magic. It's science. And so, in developing, for example, a tomahawk that's a hatchet that's going to go into the field, be used as both perhaps a combat weapon and a breaching tool, First, it's got to be strong. It's got to be durable, and you got to use the right materials. So, you know, the material considerations are more chemistry. You got to get the right steel blend to where you get good performance and good edge holding, good shock resistance, but still yet, in a way that you can sharpen it and maintain it in the field. The physics part of it goes into creating a balance. So with all of our hatchets, full size hatchets, we have a full taper from the head down through the bottom of the handle to help with the balance, and then also skeletonization inside under the handle. And what that does is that actually gives you more better weight distribution, where there's more weight in the head and less weight in the handle, just like a traditional hatchet with a wooden handle that has the eye through the steel head. It gives you a proper weight balance. So the tapering, the skeletonization, actually not only does it make it lighter to carry, but even more importantly, it balances to where the weight is in the head. So when you do have a swing, you have more velocity and therefore more power in the stride. So the weight balance becomes another critical aspect of the Tomahawk design. Now, the primary use for all of these are with a blade forward to chop. That's what axes and tomahawks and hatchets are made for. And so when we start coming up with a design that's primarily combat, then most likely it's going to have a spike on the back. So you have an alternative source to that weapon that you can use with a spike forward. Or in some cases, we may put a hammer pole on it, which adds to its functionality as a woodcraft tool, a camp chore, and perhaps in some cases for breaching. I know a lot of people that use the spike on the back end for road checks when they might have to flatten a tire to keep somebody from running away or break a window to get through glass at a checkpoint. So there's a lot of aspects that go into the design that may make its secondary purpose more functional. So that has more to do with it than the primary purpose of a chopping tool. But still, yet getting the weight distribution correct is the primary direction that we look at when we're doing the designs. And then the handle length, again, we try to balance it for the majority of the people who are using it so they don't feel the need to choke up on the handle. Because, of course, you get more velocity the longer your handle is, if that's comfortable. And I know a lot of people have used hatchets and end up choking up on the handle because it just has a better feel, a better balance for their particular size. So you take all that into consideration, too. And then handle shapes come into play, again, depending on the usage of more or less the secondary purpose and the primary purpose. So, for example, the R&D style that we touched on before, that handle design does not lend itself well to a spike forward strike. It's not made for that. The spike on the R&D Hawk is not so much a striking tool as it is a control. Then the SAOC method and style of tomahawk and hatchet fighting, that is used as a hook to maneuver your opponent into position to take advantage. So it's not really designed as a spike forward striking implement. And that is the one hatchet in our product line that is pretty much strictly combat. It doesn't lend itself well to woodcraft. It's better than not having one at all for sure, but it's a primary combat style and it's designed just specifically for that.
On that haft on the R&D, the SIOC, it right up underneath the head, it looks like a pistol grip. It's sort of canted out a little bit before the handle straightens out, and it's a perfect landing spot for your hand right underneath the head. But what is that for? Is that just the same sort of thing? I mean, if that is a combat weapon, I'm wondering what that. What the benefit of being way up under the head is.
Well, that's a good observation, and you're exactly right. So when we were designing that, Raphael and me, we try to utilize a feel and a shape that would be very comfortable and very familiar with the operators. So it does have a handgun sort of shape and feel to it. And again, the reason for that is because as a combat weapon, there are also times you don't have time and you don't have space for a full tomahawk hatchet swing. And it's an up-close, hold-in-your-hand, very close-quarters weapon. And that is why it has that secondary hand positioning up under the head for close-quarter work.
It's ferocious. It's just a terrifying-looking weapon. And seeing it all over the terminal list, I was reading the terminal list a year ago, 2021, at Blade Show. I was trying to find you at Blade Show to tell you how much I've been appreciating your knives through reading about them. But I saw Chris Pratt using that hatchet and using that part of the holding it right under the haft like that, or right under the head like that, in a very gruesome scene, which I'm glad they put in the movie because it was in the book slightly differently. But anyway, so Terminal List, Last of the Mohicans, and Zero Dark 30, and I think several others, Suicide Squad. You've made movies for knives. What's it like going from making movies for these very serious individuals whose lives rely on it, i.e. military folk and other people who buy your knives, and then making it for Hollywood producers for whom they just have to look a certain way? What's that like?
Well, you know, it all actually comes back to the functionality of it. The first movie we worked on was Last of the Mohicans. And how we got into that is at that time, Karen and I were making the historically correct and influenced designs. And we were traveling to rendezvous and custom shows to sell these items. And so we heard about this production, Last of the Mohicans, and it was based out of Asheville, North Carolina. We had a craft show at the Biltmore Estate in Asheville. And so while we were in town, we contacted the production offices and said, hey, don't know if you're interested, but we make knives and hatchets from the time period of the movie you're filming. Would you have any interest in taking a look at them? And they immediately put me in touch with prop master, Ron Downing. And his initial reaction was, gee, can you be here this evening? I have a meeting with director Michael Mann to show him the new items that I've been able to find since our last meeting. Can you bring them in and let us review what you've got? So we went to the meeting and they really were happy with what we had. And so they started between Michael and Ron, they would give us what they wanted to see for the next week's production meeting. And so for about 6 weeks, we would go home after the meeting, make what they had requested, and go back to the production meeting the next week to show them what we had. And so all these knives and hatchets and tomahawks, really, that we made during that period were early American style. They were also developed for combat of that time. And so we just accurately reproduced the designs that they wanted, like the knife made for Daniel Day-Lewis was taken from a photograph of a blade that was, I believe, displayed in a museum at Fort Niagara. The tomahawk from Magua, I think, it came from another fort up in Ohio, I believe. They actually sent me the original from the museum to copy, and of course, I had to enlarge it. So it was only 18-inch handle, and they wanted something larger for screen presence. So we did a reproduction of the tomahawk exactly like the original, except enlarged. And so we worked with them for about 6 weeks before our filming started. And then at that time, they selected what they wanted for the different characters. And we went from there. And fortunately, we were invited to come on location for some of the filming, which was very interesting, a different world from what I'd ever seen before. But it reinforced the details that certain directors go to create a realistic portrayal of what they're doing. And it also was a good insight into why it costs so much to make a movie. Because there's you might see one person out in the wilderness walking through the woods, but there's 200 others right behind him, behind his cameras, with trays of donuts and coffee and costumes and cameras and light screens, and just it was just a fascinating thing to be part of.
It must have been amazing as a lifelong lover of weapons and tools from that particular period to get an actual example in your hands from which to make the prop. That must have been pretty amazing.
It was great. It was very inspiring to see that and to hold that. And they were very protected. I would get a phone call every day to ask how it was. I hadn't heard it or anything. I said, no, I'm just looking at it, measuring it. I'm not doing anything to change it. So that was kind of neat. And then, like you said, we were talking about movies, the other movies like Zero Dark Thirty. It was authentic, a director that wanted the correct equipment to accurately portray that story. Zero Dark Thirty, that one. Suicide Squad, actually that one was more of a fantasy kind of film. But the reason we got involved with that is their consultants for the military element in that film were people that I'd worked with when they were still active duty, and they liked their stuff, and so we worked with them on that. And Terminal List came into play because the author, Jack Carr, I had met and worked with him also while he was still active. And so when he was writing his books and using some of his personal experiences in his stories, it just came into play because that was part of his life.
Okay, I have a working theory, actually, Daniel, about why, besides the fact that they're incredibly awesome, I had the Striker on loan from one of my viewers. It was so cool to have. What a beautiful knife. But anyway, I have a working theory as to why commandos and modern day, you know, elite warriors love your stuff. Not only is it, we'll set aside the fact that it's incredibly useful and utilitarian and incredible tools, but also it does harken back to an earlier time in our country. And I think a lot of men and women who put themselves, voluntarily put themselves in harm's way and join these kind of outfits are patriotic by nature. And they also have a love of history. And I think to connect yourself with some of the earlier patriots in our American history through the kind of kit you're carrying, I don't know, it could make you, emboldened on the battlefield or something. I don't know. Like I said, it's a working theory, but I love this idea of high speed, low drag commandos running around with your amazing, walnut handled, knives and tomahawks.
Well, a couple of things sparked some thoughts for me there. We do a lot of wooden handles, and most manufacturers don't do wooden handles, but our manufacturer is very different than most anybody else's manufacturing also, but we can get into that later if you like. But, one of the reasons that the wood is so popular, and that started right from the beginning working with the military operators, is it's natural and it's got a warmth. You know, the synthetic materials are great. They're very tough. We use a lot of it, and in certain situations, that is by far the best way to go with a synthetic laminate. Rubber also is one of the handle materials we use on select products because of grip and the needs in certain situations. But the wood is by far the most popular because it does have that natural warm feel. And it was told to me by one operator one time that sometimes that reminder of home and normal and natural is the difference in sanity and insanity. That they have to do, they have to live in a very insane world sometimes. And just a little bit of that reminds you of, you know, home, the wood on your firearm when you used to go deer hunting, or the mantel place over your fireplace, you know, might just be enough of a reminder to keep things kind of in check. So that's popular. And another thing you're touching on, and why a lot of operators, I believe, use our equipment, is because of the detail we go to make them functional and accessible on kit, and as easy to access and use as possible. I was teaching a course at one of the military bases on knife maintenance and sharpening. And so before going to this, I gave word to the guy that was putting it on to tell the guys to bring in their knives that they will use, and we would sharpen them. And so a guy brought in a knife, and I won't go into the details on what it was, but it was one of the more modern designs, for lack of a better word, that was designed to do everything. You could chop, you could slice, you could saw. It had something for every task that you wanted. And so this operator showed it to me and said, "What do you think of this knife?" I said, "Do you like it?" He said, "I love it." I said, "I waited a long time to get it." He said, "Well, good. That's great. I'm glad you like it." I said, "No, but I want to know what you think about it." He said, "If you like it, that's the most important thing." He said, "No, really, what do you think?" He said, "All right, I'm going to be straight up with you." And so over a period of about 7 or 8 minutes, I pointed out all the details on this particular knife, from weight and balance to unusable features, of why I would never make a knife like that. But if he liked it, that was great. I said, "Can you carry?" He says, "Yes, it's really heavy, and you gotta go through 3 snaps to get it open and get it out. So, I like to carry it, but I'm not sure I can." I said, "You know, the worst piece of gear you have in your equipment is the one that stays on the shelf when you go out in the field." And so he took his knife and held it up and walked over and he dropped it in the trash can. I said, "No, don't do that." He said, "No, man, I can't." And so he was enthusiastic, because here's a knife that should be able to do everything. And he only had to carry that one piece of equipment. But you know, when you make a piece of equipment or a tool that does too many things, it probably doesn't do any one thing very well. And so we utilized the early American and Native American design influences, because they're very simple. It's a knife designed to cut or stab, or maybe cut and stab the head to, if necessary, chop or baton through wood or whatever. And so it's very simple. Knife's been around for thousands of years, and it's really hard to do something new that actually improves it unless you come up with some better material. It's pretty hard to do. And my design influences come from a lifetime of looking at knives and hatchets and firearms and fishing rods and, you know, everything related to the outdoors and sustaining. And so that's where our influence comes from. And it's no different now than it was 300 years ago, as far as the basic need of outdoor survival in a hostile situation.
You mentioned manufacturing earlier. You're down in North Carolina. I'm in Virginia. And I know that that's where you make your work. And I've also noticed that you do some very exclusive OEM work. Dynamis, James Williams, big one that popped up. I recently was speaking with him. You make an incredible knife for him. Tell me a little bit about your manufacturing capabilities, and it seems you've got the bandwidth to make knives for other designers. Tell us a little bit about that.
We have in the past and will continue in the future to do what we call custom manufacturing. We're very selective about what we make and the designs we do, and we're not gonna just take any business in that regard. It has to be in line and flow well with our attitude about knife design and functionality and material usage and all that. So working with Don Marasso with Dynamis, he's one of the early ones. And again, another one of those relationships that developed when he was at active duty. And then as he started his own business, it was a natural fit for us to work with him. We've got product in line right now. So we do some custom manufacturing. We have had to slow down in the past couple of years just because our business has grown so much and so fast. We have a general order backlog of about 3 to 4 months right now. And then on the R&D front, SpyCalks, thank you, Jack Carr, that's about 10 months or more. And so we have a lot to do, and we're trying to spread it out. We don't want to not do these special custom manufacturing projects. So we just will continue doing it. And I like to do more as time goes along, because it's nice to be involved and have a connection with other reputable related companies like Dynamis and James Williams. And we're working on a project coming up for a couple of the gun manufacturers where there'll be accessories that go with certain guns or as an alternate product. And so we'll continue working on that as we can. And it's always good. But one of the rules that we have as far as doing these custom manufacturing projects, it's got to be a design and made in a way that if that we would sell it through our own product line. We're not going to do anything too far outside of that realm. And people are very receptive to that, because we have been fortunate enough to develop a really good reputation in this industry. And we have a good following of professionals that actually use our equipment. And that's very satisfying. And so we take that all very seriously.
So when we started this question, we're also talking about how the knives and the tomahawks are actually built. Walk us through a little bit what your manufacturing process and facility are like.
Well, it's grown over the years. Right now, I think we're in a facility about half the added up. We're probably at around 30,000 square feet. I have about 25 employees, each one of them, and that's including office staff and shipping. We don't have anybody here other than myself that makes a knife from start to finish. Everybody else has a specialty in the area. And what we've done is we've taken the methods and the procedures that I developed as a custom maker and enhanced them to where, without losing any performance or quality, we actually make them more efficient operations, such as steel. We're very selective on the steel type that we use, and I test a lot of steels to make sure we have high performance with whatever we're using. But instead of in the old days when I would take a bar of steel and hand forge it to a shape and then take a bandsaw and a grinder and take it to the final shape and profile, now we have a water jet. So we take sheets of steel, we water jet cut the blanks. That makes them very consistent and very accurate. It does not, it's not detrimental in any way to the performance of the steel. Cutting with a water jet doesn't change steel properties because there's no heat generated. And it's a computer controlled operation. And now we've eliminated for that procedure the hot fire and the hammer, which is potentially dangerous. We've eliminated the bandsaw work, cutting out the blanks, which I'd say at least 3 out of the 7 times I've had stitches has been because of a bandsaw. So we've eliminated the made it safety. We take safety very seriously. So we have a water jet, and we also have machines that do preliminary grinds to remove the bulk of the material. But then every single piece that we make also is hand ground by an operator that I personally have worked with training to get them to know how to get these knives and hatchets to the final dimensions. So there's still a lot of handwork involved in it. And then from there it goes to, heat treating, and I set up our heat treating using the same methods that I did as a custom maker that created the very high performance tools, using a salt pot system. So it's not the fastest way to do it, and it's not the safest way to do it, but it does give you the best performance, especially with the type of steels that we're using. It's not for all steels, but for the steel that we use is very well suited to it for a high performance process. So, you know, another thing that we do different than other manufacturers, which is more in line with what I did as a custom maker, is we completely grind the blades to shape before heat treating. And then we heat treat, and unfortunately sometimes we get warpage, so we probably have a loss factor on warpage of about anywhere from 5 to 10%, depending on the particular model and the steel at the time. Where other manufacturers generally will heat treat the blank and then do the grinding processes by machine under a water flow to keep the steel cool to preserve the hardness levels, which does work in a lot of cases, especially on the thinner steels. But when you get the steel of the thickness, like for a belt knife, for example, which is approximately 3/16 of an inch thick. And so I did some testing with layering some steel and taking it apart and doing hardness and performance tests on the outer layers or the inner layers. And you can have a 2 to 3 point difference in hardness level just because when you cool it for the hardening process, you cooling the outside insulates the inside, which becomes your cutting edge eventually from the cooling process, and you have less performance in that part of the steel. So we do all of our shaping before heat treating to give our customers, our users, a longer usable lifespan on their knives. And again, it enhances the performance level.
When you say shaping, are you talking about the main bevels, or are you talking about the profile, or all of it?
The profiles, pretty much everybody does profiles with either a laser, a stamping machine, or a water jet. That's pretty standard. Custom makers, since they don't normally have a water jet to use, or a laser that can cut that thick of steel, they hand shape it with a bandsaw and a grinder. Every manufacturer I know of has the profiles done from some computer-controlled machine or a stamping machine. From that standpoint, and again, most manufacturers that I'm aware of do the heat treating after that blank is formed, and then they go in for grinding hardened steel. And these machines, even the machines I have, are capable of grinding hardened steel. It's just we don't do it that way
because
our number one focus is performance. And so we try to do things that have the best performance that we can possibly get. And I found for our pile processes, that's the way that we do it.
And you're willing to sacrifice 5 to 10% of what you're making to make sure that that performance is there. And I think the end user really appreciates that, because oftentimes their lives depend on it.
Well, they do. And that's one thing that we realized from the beginning, that there are people out there who will actually put their life on the line based on the performance of their equipment. And like I said, initially when we started working with the military, my intention was to do design and development, contract out the manufacturing, somebody set up for it, because a two-person operation, me and Darren, could not produce those kind of numbers. And we're not talking big numbers. We're talking small numbers in the terms of what most knife companies make. It's still too much for two people. But we also realized when we were looking into this and looking at contractors to do other operations that they had their methods that didn't really mesh with what I knew I wanted done to assure the performance of these guys that literally might rely on that with their life or don't have a failure. And so we decided at that time, if we're going to get into this side of the business, then we're going to do it right, or we're not going to do it at all. And it's paid off very well. We've been very successful as a business. We're very successful with our views on this, because although from 1988 to about 2004, 2005, all Karen and I did were one-of-a-kind pieces that 9 out of 10 went into collections and never cut anything. And I appreciate that. It helped me make a living and raise kids and send them to school and start this other business. But there is also a very deep satisfaction in now making knives that 9 out of 10 go in the field and are working knives, where there's few that are going to collections, and that's fine. But I know they're going to be, for the most part, out there in the field working, which is a very satisfying thought.
What kind of feedback? I mean, I'm sure it's been years and years and millions of emails, but what kind of feedback do you get from people in the field with your work?
We get a lot of feedback about performance and how they love the feel of it, that it's a comfortable knife to use. It's one that when you hold it, it just makes you want to get out and use it, and that's very satisfying. We get some more detailed feedback from actual uses. I had one gentleman that worked within the military, and he was in a somewhat covert operation, and they had to stop a communications network, and he to do so, he took his belt knife and jammed it into an electrical circuit to short it out. Of course, he lost his knife doing that. And but he wrote us details about how he did this and how it completed the mission successfully. So, of course, we sent him a new one. I get other details, and some that we can share openly, and some that we don't talk about just because we're very, I won't say protective, but respectful of the personal security of some of the people that actually use our equipment. So we don't get into any details about who our customers are. But in general, they're the guys that do the higher skill level jobs in a lot of cases. And then we also, as we go along, we have more and more people that are in the more regular military that have found a use for our equipment. When they're allowed to carry their own equipment, they do. And sometimes they buy it themselves, and sometimes we've worked on government contracts, we've worked on, squadron purchases with their discretionary funds, and it goes a lot of different directions.
I really like the story about the guy that you just told, using his knife to short out a certain... That's not the kind of thing you expect to hear. You expect to hear, I used the axe to breach a door and it saved the day, or maybe use the knife to protect yourself in a close encounter. But I love that. He used it, jammed it in. It worked. It did its job. You have a couple of other tools that are pretty cool that I've had a chance to check out. One of them is a spike. The other one is like a tactical screwdriver. The viewer who loaned me the combat strike, or the striker with the stuff in the hidden handle. He also loaned me that screwdriver and the spike and all those other tools. Very cool, very useful, doubling as weapons. Tell me a little bit about what inspired the creation of these kind of knife things.
Well, originally that we call it a pick. That was inspired from two different directions. One, at the time, I was kind of interested and watched that TV series, Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. And so and then another issue I had at work was when we were cutting out these axes, there was a lot of steel that wasn't big enough to cut the axe, and there was a lot of what I considered waste. And I wanted to find a use for that waste. I said, okay, we'll make a walker spike. Yeah, people might like that and utilize this waste of material. We decided that walker spike might be copyrighted, so we just called it a pick. So that it came from a thought process of trying to utilize some wasted materials, but it became very popular. And then we did the screwdriver, and then did a tactical flathead, which is the same basic thing for dynamos, which was great. And they became very popular, and it became so popular, in fact, that we no longer could cut enough of them out of the waste material. We had to set up cut full sheets, and so it changed the cost of the product. And but more than that, as time went and we got more and more behind on orders for knives and hatchets, and again, a lot of this is going to professionals, that's where the picks, we had to make a difficult choice to grind a pick. It took the same amount of time as it did to grind a belt knife. And it didn't make sense because it wasn't as critical a piece of equipment. Mm-hmm. And so we had to make the choice, and we discontinued those, the picks and the screwdriver pick. But the good news is we're going to bring them out again, but with a little slightly different design. And we're going to assign specific time for them and manufacture them in a way that's a little more efficient. And so we can bring in. So 2023, keep your eyes open for new versions, Gen 2 of both those products. And we want to change the design, not only for manufacturing efficiency, but also when we discontinued the pick and screwdriver pick, then they became very sought after on the secondary market. And right now, this pick that we sold, I think, for about $85 are regularly selling on the secondary market for anywhere from $250 to $500 and for collectors. And collectors drive that kind of market.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I would never make a product like that and sell it for that amount because I could, because it's not my philosophy. It's not our philosophy on how to do business. But I'm not knocking anybody that's doing that. That's once they get into the customer's hands, they're free to do whatever they want to.
Sure.
But we are planning to bring it back, and as well as hopefully in the future, we're going to start doing some kitchen cutlery, some outdoor grilling knives and cleavers and things that we see a need for. But we've got to get a manufacturing to where we're not so backlogged before we really can bring in any new products like that.
Folders. I noticed, I think it was last year, you did a collaboration with Boker Knives. Was it Boker?
Yeah. That one has been in the works for about 10 years, I guess. And I did a design with Boker. Initially, their thoughts were, after we did the design, that they wanted to send it and have it made in Asia. And they do some great knives in China and now, and that's fine, but it's not where we are as a company. Mm-hmm. And so when they wanted to make it in Germany, and I thought, well, that's okay. I have we have a lot of customers and a lot of military connections in allied countries. And so they ended up doing it in Italy, which I'm fine with that too. It's very nice. Not the knife manufacturing is done by Fox, which is extremely high quality. And so when they came out with it, I was happy to see it. And you know, it's not like I gave royalties or anything off that. It's just a project that I wanted to do because, you know, I like Boker. I've carried Boker knives myself and was very happy to work with them. And so that was great. And we tried to do some folding knives ourselves. And we did several. We did the F1, the F1B several years ago, and then we did an F3. And these are very collectible, too. And then we did a folding knife liner lock design for 6 Hour. And so we've done some, but we did have to contract out the CNC work on those because we don't have the equipment to do that. And our philosophy, I won't say has changed, but we have narrowed it down to where all the operations, with the exception of a little bit of heat treating and some of the sheath base platforms that we use, we do it all in-house. And so that's why we quit making folding knives, is because until we're ready to set up that kind of CNC equipment to do them again ourselves, or to keep it in-house, we're just not going to get into that market. There's a lot of companies out there like Boker that make exceptionally good folding knives. And the only similarity in a folding knife and fixed blade knife is they're both called a knife. Anything else is a total different animal. It's not even similar in the processes for the most part. So we focus on what we do best, fixed blade knives and hatchets and other tools. And I'm going to pretty much stick to that, I believe. Maybe in the future for the next generations, I'm going to do folding knives again. I won't fight them, but for right now, I don't think it's in my future anyway, other than collaborations with company like Boker. And I think we're talking about doing a slightly smaller version of that knife for the next run. And they're done in small batches, limited editions. The first edition, I believe, was 300. And the next edition may be a little bit more. That is all up to Boker. But I hope to have a good number of them myself for sale when they come out. And this Boker knife now, which is sold out, as far as I know, in the market, I do have a few of them here that I was able to get, and we're going to sell them. We'll talk about where I'm going to sell them when we get to that point, but it will be on the website.
Well, in closing, I have to ask, are you still doing your custom work? Is that something you still do for yourself, or has that gone by the wayside as production increases and all that?
Karen and I have not taken any custom orders since, I think, 2006 or 2007. We haven't produced any for sale. I still do a little bit of the hand-forged one-of-a-kind pieces for reasons. One is when we may do a prototype on a new product, such as the Highland Hunter and the Highland Hatchet, actually hand-forged prototypes for those. And then once I got them right, like I wanted, because they were very historically influenced designs, we did CAD drawings of those originals to do in production. A second reason that I do occasionally is these knives of the hand forged that are not available anymore have a good value. And so if I want to support a charitable organization such as one of the SEAL foundations police or whatever, if I want to do something really special that brings some extra money, I may hand forge a knife for them to sell in an auction to bring in extra money. And a third reason is on occasion, because of our military contacts, I have done this on a few occasions to help with some winding down after a particular difficult deployment or something, bring some of these guys into the shop and I'll take them through and let them hand forge a blade, show them how to do it and help them along with it and forge it and grind it and heat treat it, put the handle on, just as sort of as a therapy thing. And so I enjoy doing that on occasion. So there are a few out there, new ones that come out. There's some that come out that we did years ago on the secondary market that are bringing a whole lot more than I ever sold before. But good for the collector market. But as far as doing that and taking orders and selling, I don't see that enough.
Well, Daniel Winkler, what a pleasure and an honor to have you on the Knife Junkie podcast, sir. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us skimming the surface on your career in knives. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you. I appreciate the opportunity to let people know who I am and what Winkler Knives is, because there's a lot of talk that goes on out there and there's some misconceptions on what we do and who we do it for. And it's always an opportunity to make sure the record is as clear as possible.
Well, I'm glad we could do that for you, sir. But for me, selfishly, it was just a pleasure meeting you.
Well, thank you. Pleasure meeting you.
Do you use terms like handle to blade ratio, walk and talk, hair pop and sharp, or tank-like? Then you are a dork and a knife junkie.
Well, there he goes, ladies and gentlemen. Daniel Winkler. So cool to meet him and to talk to him. And it kind of made me feel a little cagey when he said knives just boil down to geometry, physics, and chemistry. I was like, I should have been paying more attention in school. In any case, great to have him here. Be sure to check us out next week for another great interview, Wednesday for the midweek supplemental, and join us again Thursday night, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Thursday Night Knives, live on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitch. For Jim working his magic behind the switcher, I'm Bob DeMarco saying until next time, don't take dull for an answer.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at reviewthepodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, theknifejunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at theknifejunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on theknifejunkie.com/Instagram and join our Facebook group at theknifejunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to bob@theknifejunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487 and you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.